Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and hi y'all, and good day, mates. I want to thank you all for coming here tonight, because I wish that you could feel coursing through your veins the emotion that I do, because to be with you here tonight is a lifelong ambition of mine. To come to Australia, when I read Michael Cannon's introduction in the MUP edition, when he thanks the Virginia State Librarian for a valiant effort to try and find out information about him in Virginia, but he was unsuccessful, the light bulb went off in my head and I said, I know, I must contact people in Australia. And I tried for several years until finally, when I Googled him just every now and then to see if there's something new, found an article about he'd been admitted to the Melbourne Media Hall of Fame, and there were two email addresses. Immediately fired off an email to both of them and said within the body of that, by the way, is Michael Cannon still around? Mercy. I want to thank, before I begin, I want to thank Michael, I want to thank Willa, and I want to thank Michael's posterity who's here tonight for the hospitality, the generosity, and the patience that they've given me while my stay here. You have a wonderful land. It's been a great opportunity for me living in true vagabond style here down under. It's been fantastic. I want to thank also the people in my hometown in Farmville, because people always wondered about that old house up on the hill on the edge of town, but they never really knew much about it. And once I came up with the research, figured it all out, and presented it to the Historical Society, it kind of really took in the community with a newspaper article, a presentation that I did for the Historical Society, and the people realized that this was going to be quite difficult for me to come here. They banded together. I didn't ask them for anything. They held a silent auction. They solicited donations within the community and raised $3,500 US to help me make this trip here. So I want to thank the people of Farmville, Prince Edward County, and the membership of my Farmville Prince Edward Historical Society. And here I am with you. Thank you for thanking them. Now, as a gift from them to the society here, I've delivered to Christine a CD-ROM disc of photographs of the home that we're going to take a look at here in a little bit, so that you can have for your records as to what the vagabond is. Michael and I have discussed the only home the man ever owned, and yet he probably only lived in it 4 to 6 weeks maximum before fleeing here. And as he has said, Virginia's loss was Australia's gain. Ladies and gentlemen, come with me tonight and let's share the last 6 months of the vagabond before he became the vagabond, his life in Virginia before you welcomed him to your shores. And let's see here. All right, Christine, let's see if I can't get this thing going. I guess we're going to start first with a little kind of a shameless plug for a recent publication that has come out. You may have heard of it. Here we go. I don't know if you've seen this or not. Was that not great? Zal, could you tell us the story of how this came about? Please give them my thank you, because it was fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, let us begin. From the Commonwealth of Virginia, the Old Dominion, mother of presidents, and the home to the Southern Confederate capital, let's explore the last 6 months of the life of John Stanley James in Virginia before he fled to Australia. Now, you'll excuse me, but this is in the Virginia State Parks PowerPoint template. That's why you'll see that. I do lots of these different historical subjects for outreach programming. So that's why you'll see the Virginia State Parks emblem. I'm a ranger with the parks. Our story begins with the conclusion of the American Civil War. This will bring about the opportunity that brings James to Virginia. Portrayed here, you will see the surrender of Ewell's Corps at Sailor's Creek on April the 6th of 1865, and is also another shameless plug for yet another Virginia state park, Sailor's Creek Historical Battlefield Park. With the conclusion of the war, Virginia was laid a vanquished land. What you had was a defeated people who now had to find a way to rise up and seek out a new social and economic order in concert with the newly emancipated Negroes. After the war, there were two major waves of migration that come to Southside Virginia. The first was primarily composed of people from the North whose motivations of political dominance were largely transparent, and for the most part they were resented, regarded as carpetbaggers. As a result, very few of them were ever actually really accepted in by the people of the South. But by 1868, another wave of migration arrives in Southside, that of Englishmen who came and intended to colonize an area south of the James River to the North Carolina border. Well, James would be one of these people who would seek an opportunity or find one to come to Virginia. What you see here is a depiction of the SS Adriatic. This would be the ship that we believe that he arrived in the United States on. The Adriatic was kind of like the Concorde of its time. It was christened in the fall of 1871, but didn't make its maiden voyage until about April or May of 1872, from Liverpool to New York. James is either on this inaugural run or subsequently shortly thereafter. And we know this because in an article printed in the Farmville Mercury, our newspaper of the time period in 1875, an article about James appears here, saying that this gentleman who recently located in Farmville is the identical party who 3 years ago made a steerage passage from Liverpool to New York for the purpose of finding out how immigrants fared on shipboard. And I'll explain why he would be doing this. James's letters were simultaneously published in the London Daily News and New York Tribune, caused an extraordinary sensation on both sides of the Atlantic. Ladies and gentlemen, this is an avenue of research that needs to be pursued to find these letters, as yet I have been unable to find them. But I'm sure that this is not an embellishment. This has got to be true because he's with his ilk, other British or Englishmen, who would know at the time that this was a contemporary event. Originally, I believe James comes to America in association with this gentleman, Joseph Arch, a primitive English preacher, rose from the ranks of a yeoman farmer to be elected to Parliament and was the founder of the National Union of Agricultural Workers. I think James is probably with this gentleman when he makes a tour of Canada in 1873. The reason I say this is this article found in the December 6th, 1873 article of an Alexandria, Virginia newspaper says that Mr. Arch has left behind, this agent's name is J.S. Stanley James, who advises Americans who want to help forward to get English farmers to America donations to help reduce their passage from like $25 to $5. So James is trying to help. What Arch realizes is this crushing burden of time-honored tradition on the farmers in England. If you can get them out of England and get them to Canada, the United States, New Zealand, Australia, there they can stand on an equal footing with the people that they work for and can have a more even chance of making success in life. Now, the editor would respond to this by saying that, you know, that why should we give money to these people? I mean, if the Englishmen want to come here, let them come on their own. Our happiness is not dependent on them. If they want to come here, let them pay their own way. So the editor was not very sympathetic to this effort. But this tells me that he was associated with Joseph Arch. Now the name again, J.S. Stanley James, I have no idea what that second S is all about. But when he comes to Farmville, he's going to assume a different identity. James arrives in Farmville on March the 8th of 1875 in the presence of a fellow by the name of James R. Slayton, publisher of the South Magazine up in New York, a magazine that's dedicated towards economic development in the South. Arriving in Farmville, he got off the train. Then it would be the Atlantic, Mississippi, and Ohio, originally the South Side Railroad. And this building that you see here is the train station where James would disembark. You can see the railroad car to the right. That's my trail that I work for. I work for a rails to trails conversion park that's 31 miles long. So I go right along that rail side right through the town of Farmville. Once he gets off, disembarks here, he crosses the street to this, the Randolph House, Farmville's primary hostelry of the time. Now this building was significant just 10 years earlier. In 1865, in the closing days of the American Civil War, on April 6th, it was the headquarters of General Lee's staff. Lee stayed in a private residence a few streets over. The next night, on April the 7th, 1865, it was the headquarters for General Grant and his general staff. The Union 6th Corps occupied Farmville about noon to 1 o'clock that day. The Confederates had burned the bridges in town and fled across the Appomattox River into Cumberland to enjoy or feast on the first distribution of rations since leaving Petersburg. These guys were absolutely famished, so Lee's strategy becomes one of using the river as a barrier. That evening, Grant would come out onto the veranda. When the pontoons had been laid, the 6th Corps is marching right across the main street. Grant came out of the building so flushed with a sense of victory, he went back inside and he penned the first note of surrender to General Lee, saying, "The events of the last week must convince you of the hopelessness of any further resistance on the part of the CS Army in this struggle. I believe it is so, and therefore shift for myself the responsibility for any further effusion of blood by asking of you the surrender of that portion of the CS Army known as the Army of Northern Virginia." That note would be passed through the lines north of town at Cumberland Church that night, the last Confederate victory. General Lee read it. He handed it to his war horse, old Pete Longstreet, who read it, handed it back, saying, "Not yet." And the retreat continued. The next day, James and his party would go down Main Street and they would go to the courthouse, which would be the building on your right. The one on the left is the clerk's office. Here was a meeting of the Farmville British Association, where they held a reception for James there. And it was here that James would make a speech, which is printed, the text of it, in the Farmville Mercury of the time. What I found to be significant about this is James and Slayton proposed the development of the Southside Immigration Society in order to try and recruit more Englishmen to this area. And also, I found significant here, James mentions why he left England, being, "I am a plain, modest man. Many of the cherished institutions of our native land were too much for me. And so I have fled to these hospitable shores, making my home here, where I trust that this great country may remain ever governed by the people, for the people." Now, that's kind of vague, but I think you can read within the lines there that he indeed was not happy in England. The next day, they take a ride south of town to Hampden-Sydney College and the home of the Union Theological Seminary, where he said they had excellent facilities, and he also encountered this individual, Robert Louis Dabney, Hampden-Sydney graduate of 1837. He was chief of staff and biographer to General Stonewall Thomas Jonathan Jackson, chaplain of the 18th Virginia Infantry Regiment, church architect. He designed several churches, three of which are on the historic register. He was also the professor of mental and moral philosophy at the University of Texas by 1883. Now, in 1895, he is still in Texas preaching from the pulpit that slavery should still exist. Amazing. By the end of March, James has decided to relocate to Farmville, purchase 90 acres of land known as Lake Hill for $1,700, and stated his intent was to erect a grand residence on the hill. Here's the article that mentions that. Bought it for $1,700. Mr. Moth, Alfred Moth, was the first English immigrant to come to Farmville. Mentions it was part of the old Randolph estate, the Bazaar Plantation it was known as. and mentions the house, which does indeed command splendid views of the surrounding country, and you'll see that in a moment. This is sort of a map of Farmville at the time. Okay, without me being able to. The land he purchased is right about in this area here. This will be the houses, because this map was made in 1878. The cartographer was a fellow by the name of Henry Jacob, another one of these English immigrants. There's a difference between the immigrants that are here in Farmville and the ones that Arch tried to get over here. Arch tried to get yeoman farmers. The ones that came to Farmville were actual professional class individuals, retired military, clergy, engineers, builders. They had skills. Now, James, he comes to Farmville assuming this persona of a man of letters. He's Dr. J.S. Stanley James. But his community involvement was quite extensive and chronicled in the local newspaper, the Farmville Mercury, which is also published by another one of these English immigrants, a fellow by the name of Joseph Andrew Horner St. Andrew. He is the one who initially invites James to Farmville. By the first part of April, 1875, James, Slayton, and St. Andrews go on a whirlwind speaking tour of Southside Virginia. And one of their first stops is Chase City, down in Mecklenburg County, Virginia. Chase City is one of these towns established by these English immigrants that came here. And actually, St. Andrew was from Chase City, and he was in the process of moving to Farmville. He sold the newspaper there in Chase City and bought the one in Farmville. But when they go to Chase City, they speak to the Board of Settlers, much like they did to the British Association in Farmville. The significance that I see in this speech here is James begins, first off, a very humorous reference to the poor road conditions by alluding to the famous Henry Stanley and Dr. Livingston encounter in Africa, saying he didn't know much about the roads in Ujiji, but if they were anything like the roads leading to Chase City, I am not at all surprised that Livingston remained so long lost to the world. Thought that was good. But I thought significant about this. This is where he declared that he was a naturalized American citizen and encouraged all the settlers to seek American citizenship. This is going to get him in trouble later. Now, how he becomes a naturalized citizen, I don't know. I'm beginning to think that his marriage may have been his ticket to being an American citizen. I'm just not familiar with the naturalization process at the time. Now, as I mentioned earlier, St. Andrew, the newspaper editor, he was living in Chase City, where he published the Southside Virginian, sold it, purchased the Farmville Commonwealth, which he renamed the Farmville Mercury. But one thing I found interesting about that is, being a newspaper guy, I worked with the Farmville Herald years ago, where you have your volume number and issue number, he didn't start, when he changed the name to Farmville Mercury, didn't start with volume one, number one. He just kept the same serial going, whatever that number was, to the number of the issue. I thought that that was kind of interesting, just being a newspaper guy. All right, while in Chase City, this is one of the references to the blacks in the local community. Because St. Andrew was moving to Farmville, the local blacks wanted to have a reception in St. Andrew's honor. So they had him come to their church, the Colored Baptist Church. And this is significant, I think, in James's observation of the Negroes of the area. He said to them that the colored people of Chase City were in a far-off better position, relatively, than the agricultural laborers of England. They were paid for their labor and could, through thrift and pluck, acquire land, exercise a vote, very important, and in this regard, they were far better off than their European agricultural counterparts. Another endeavor of these English immigrants was to establish in the southwest portion of Prince Edward County another colony known as Clarendon. And let's see if I can get to here. Our cartographer, he lived right there, Henry Jacob. This is Darlington Heights in the southwest corner of Prince Edward County. Farmville would be up here, Hampden, Sydney, the old courthouse this way, and this right here, St. Anne's Church. One of the legacies of these English immigrants was the establishment of Episcopal churches. This is a little article about it, having it consecrated. It's just a little tiny little building that was going to be in this colony that they were establishing. This is what it looks like today. Basically, you just have that the church was moved to Appomattox, where it serves the Episcopal congregation there, about 1949 or 50. And now you just have a little brick pillar with a marble tablet on the top that reads such as. So all these English immigrants, they go there on this day, I think it was June 10th, 1875, to consecrate the church with this famous bishop who comes in named Bishop Johns. After the consecration of the church, everybody leave the church and then go just a little bit east up to here, this house, Oakland, occupied by a fellow by the name of Thomas Homer. He was the main mover and shaker to get this colony going. And here they have a repast and also a cricket game ensues, or match, I guess you call it. I mean, the average American, we hear cricket and we're just like, huh? What? So I thought that this was interesting because the newspaper said that James in the match exhibited some excellent play. So we know that he did have some form of athletic prowess about him. Now, one of the people associated with him in this game was a fellow by the name of Walter Powis. He had a brother named Arthur also. They owned a plantation more towards Farmville. This guy was like the Michael Jordan, the Mickey Mantle, the Joe Namath of cricket players at that time. And he lived in Farmville, Virginia, of all places. And he was known as a Molly Duker for being a left-handed batsman who bowled left arm, round arm, fast. Now, when I do this at home, I say, don't feel bad, folks. I don't understand that either. But I hope that rings a bell with you guys. Good, good. His brother Arthur actually would be killed in Argentina a few years later by a bunch of natives there who stole some horses, and then they got a posse together to go after the natives, and they fell into an ambush, and he got killed with a spear thrust. Also, this Walter Powis and James were interested in wildlife and importing English wildlife to Virginia. And our guy James writes for this magazine, a weekly magazine that costs $5 a year subscription, known as Forest and Stream. And he writes about Powis, saying that returning from an important cricket match at Cambridge in 1874, Powis imported 2 pairs of pheasants and 32 pairs of rabbits. About half were a black variety from Hawkstone. All were released on his property in Tuggle. Now, it mentions that they looked like crows milling about the pasture in the distance, and I've also wondered if they did not interbreed with the local rabbits, perhaps. You know, I guess you'd have to do some animal DNA or something, but another person told me, no, that they're two different genetic types and wouldn't. In other words, these black rabbits probably just ended up feeding the coyotes. The one big legacy, tangible legacy of James in Farmville was his house. That's the one thing we really have left of him. And this article that I found, this is what nailed it for me, because as a young romantic coming home from college, wandering the old railroad bed at the base of the hill, and you come through this canopy of growth through an ancient forgotten section of Farmville, and there above you on the left would be this house up on the hill. I mean, it's just like something the Addams Family or the Munsters could be coming out of. I mean, it's just like a magnet, moth to the flame. So I would go there, go up in the high tower and look at it. This expansive view of the countryside. Perfect place for a young romantic to figure out the mystery of this house. But I couldn't figure it out. And what ends up happening is I'm just going through the Farmville Mercury papers, just looking for historical things in the local area, when I ran across this article about how that house was built in less than 10 weeks. When it said J.S. Stanley James and his family moving in, I've seen a lot about this guy in the newspaper prior, so that's why I go back and look up more about him. The architect and builder was another English immigrant, Frederick Harper Twelve Trees. This is what the house looked like. Is that not neat? Can you imagine going up in that tower? And I mean, you're up on a tall hill as it is. And Twelve Trees said in the article the biggest difficulty he had was getting materials on site, no doubt due to the steep incline going up to it. These photos were taken probably about 1998, about 2000. And the disc, Christine, is pretty much right about that time or maybe just a little later. This would be the back side of it. The small building that you see to the left is, I guess, the summer kitchen or servants' quarters, more than likely. This is that view from down at the bottom that I'm looking up, seeing, going, wow, I've got to go up and see that.
I knew the people who owned the property. The house was wide open, just go into it. They used it to store tractor implements and parts in because they ran that type of business. Now, in researching James to figure out what happened to him, his connection, when I read the Australian Dictionary biography online, and it says he came from Virginia, but then goes down to Australia, and he writes all these other books. This one, Cannibals and Convicts from 1886, which contains the information that Willow was speaking about here earlier. This is what nailed it when I realized this is indeed our God. How well I remember standing on a bluff looking over the Appomattox, the river winding a silver streak through the valley, the slopes green with tobacco plants, the distant woods tinged with lovely shades of blue and red. That's looking west to the Blue Ridge Mountains. Below us, hundreds of Negroes, the men all in black, the women with many a streak of color in the bright kerchiefs around their necks and twisted on their heads. A stone's throw on the bluff above them, unknown Confederate and Federal dead were buried together. That's a reference to our Confederate cemetery. Here we'd fought one of our last fights with Grant, so short a time and in events yet so long. Randolph of Roanoke, John Randolph of Roanoke, who he's referring to, on whose land we stood, loved not slavery. He released his bondsmen at his death. But I think, if possible, his bones would have turned in his grave if he'd heard the excited preachers on the bank urging the Negroes against sin and to lead a new life, namely to avoid whiskey drinking and to vote the Republican ticket. What he's doing is comparing a baptism between the Kanek, and he's seeing that in Fiji, I believe, and then it reminded him of these baptisms of the American Negroes in my area. When I read this passage, this is what nailed it for me, that this is indeed our guy right here. Now, James not only intended to reside in this home, but he was going to operate a school known as Stanley Park Academy. And if you read through here, you'll also see that he intends to a select number of boys under 16 years of age will be received by the principal to educate with his own children. Now, these are going to be stepchildren of his. But I just think when you look at the curriculum, English with special attention to grammar and writing, you couldn't have had a better teacher in the world than Dr. J.S. Stanley James to teach you English. This is what his legacy looks like today. It was actually dismantled and moved about 10 miles down the road west towards Prospect by some good friends of mine, Gordon and Alicia Johnson. And this is what it looks like today. And from the backside, that's them sitting on the rock wall there. They are who I regard to patron saints, saviors of this home, because that 90 acres of property was bought by the Lakeville University. If you go there now, you would never recognize it. It is full of duplexes and dormitories and dining halls and sports fields, and they were going to destroy this house, just burn it down to get rid of it. And they stepped in and bought it for $1 and got, they had to move it. And they got a year to do it, needed a little extra time. Probably took them about a year and a half to get it moved and then put up. And this is all about 2005, I believe. So thank you, Gordon and Alicia, for saving that one lasting, tangible legacy of our hero. Now, what went wrong? Why does James flee to here? Okay. There's not one reason, but several. A perfect storm of unfortunate events that occurred to him. But they're all based largely on a financial reason. James, because of him being such a raconteur and so well-educated and just a smooth talker, he ends up getting put on the board of the English and American Bank in town. And one way that I'm judging his favorability in the community at the time is his name being, is that it? No. Right there. His name being in that ad. That would start in May of 1875 and end the first week of September. So when I'm reading all this in the papers, all of a sudden his name's gone off the ad. All mentions of him in the newspaper ceases. Something is wrong here because he was so popular, he's in the paper every week. Something's wrong. I've got to figure this out. And lo and behold, this is one reason when I read that initial passage where we nailed it out of Cannibals and Convicts. That's when I realized I've got to buy more of James's primary works, because he makes references to things back in Virginia without saying it, that the ordinary or average Australian reader wouldn't pick up on, but that I would. And this was the one, I believe, that nails his problem with the financial matter with the bank. And this comes out of the fourth series. I believe it's in the article entitled A Peep at the Blacks. I was a bank director myself once. This is just 2 years later now. But I failed in the business. In truth, I was anything but a success and quarreled with my comrades at the board because they would not lend money to my personal friends. People would come and implore me to get their bills discounted for a few hundred or $1,000. I could never resist such appeals. And when the board quite properly refused to advance money on valueless security, I often scribbled my name on the back of a bill and made myself responsible. After losing a few thousand dollars at this game, I came to the conclusion that nature never intended me for a usurer. I think we're alluding to or referring to his experience as a bank board director in Farmville. Absolutely. Okay, so that's part of it. He gets in trouble that way. One of the more mysterious aspects of James's life is his brief marriage to a woman by the name of Carolyn Lewis James, and James being, of course, his last name. She was described by J.B. Cooper in his article, the January 1st, 1912, Who Was the Vagabond article, at Life magazine, as a rich Southern lady, the widow of a planter from Richmond, Virginia, who had a family and also the temper of a Southerner. Oh, boy, I know all about that. Michael and I have discussed this. When I go back, this has to be a primary focus or priority of mine, is to figure this woman out. I've hit a dead end with this thing. I don't know what to do. And I'm probably just going to have to hire a genealogist to try and figure this out, because the surname thing can change. Doing genealogy on women is a whole lot harder than men, generally, just because of that name change. But it was her money that he lost, and this is causing an irreconcilable difference between the two. It's just like dominoes falling for him at this point. There's an article or a memorandum of dated August 28, 1875, in the clerk's office, a memorandum of agreement where she gives him $5 for the house, the property, and all the contents. And he says in the document that he relinquishes her from any further debt incurred by him. So she has been ruined by this man. And also, there's another English immigrant in town by the name of Charles Bug. He runs this grocery store. You can see the painted on the side. He would be one of the immigrants who actually stays in Farmville. Most of the farmers actually go back to England. But the merchant class, the professional builder, contractor class, they stay and make a go in Farmville. He actually serves a warrant on our guy for a trifling sum of money. And it so infuriated our man, he put a notice in the paper saying, "It's been reported that I've lost money by the failure of Duncan Sherman and Company of New York." He was invested in that. It's like an investment firm. Well, then went belly up. So, boom, loses all this money. Probably Caroline's money. And whereas Charles Bug of Farmville, with the knowledge of the foregoing, employed a constable to demand from me a trifling disputed account, which uncalled for action has greatly injured my credit. Know now, all men, that notwithstanding the aforesaid, I, the undersigned, am quite capable of paying 200 cents on the dollar, and any just claims against me will be paid when presented. At the same time here, the Farmville British Association has their annual banquet. Our man is absent. He's so humiliated. He's been he doesn't look good at all. He's becoming persona non grata in the community. But this is an organization our guy would thrive in, with all these toasts to the queen and things like that. He's vacant, not there. Something's wrong. The last straw will be he gets involved in this contentious letter exchange with the very man who invited him to Farmville, J.A.H. St. Andrew, who accuses the vagabond, who's not yet the vagabond yet, James, of hatred of the mother country. Because of James's contention, trying to get people to become American citizens. Some of them were agreeable to that, but a lot of them were not. They were content being British subjects in America, colonizing Virginia. They hated the Grant administration. I read that quite often in the paper. So the same guy who invited him just 6 months prior, And this is kind of what the article series looks like. It's entitled Anglo-Virginians. Now, we're not going to go through the full content of that because it's just, there's no need to. But I will say this to you. The influence to James that brought him here were the writings of Anthony Trollope, because he quotes it in these letters. That works that he did, the two-volume set, Australia, New Zealand, he quotes from that. And to me, this is why he liked what he read, what Trollope's descriptions of your area here. And this is what influenced him to go to Australia. Blast you, James, if you'd only stayed and wrote back home the way you did here. All right. Now, October 26, 1875, in the minutes of the Southside Immigration Society notes printed in the newspaper, there's a paragraph that says, on the motion of Colonel Fitzgerald, seconded by Dr. Thaxton, he was a dentist in town, became the founder of the Virginia Dental Association. It was resolved that the office of corresponding secretary, which our guy possessed, had become vacant by reason of the continued absence of Farmville of the member elected to that position. They don't even mention the man's name. Are they that embarrassed at his actions? January of 1876, the contents of the house are being auctioned off. This was part of a big advertisement placed in January issue of the Farmville Mercury. You see the contents. If you just read through here, all the furniture and the different things you have, you go to the very bottom, a collection of pure gold jewelry, including heavy Albert chain, bracelets, etc. Lot number 29, several ladies' dresses, etc., all to be sold in parcels. Carolyn was left in a dire strait, I read from this. And so everything's being sold to pay off the debts that they owe, or that she is stuck with, I guess. Now, in Cannibals and Convicts, James makes a lot of Masonic references to things. He even has in the beginning, so mote it be, one of the common sayings. Anybody here a Mason? Is the Masonic fraternity here popular at all or common? It's a dying craft. It really is. Even in Farmville, it is. There's very few members under 60 years of age now. So he made a lot of references to that, but he never really says he was a Mason, but I did some research at the Grand Lodge in Virginia and found, sure enough, he had joined the Farmville Lodge, AFAM, Ancient Free and Accepted Masons, number 41. He's expunged from the membership roll on February 26, 1876, for non-payment of dues, because he's long gone by then, folks. When he drops that last letter in the mail, probably dated September 30th, 1875, he didn't hang around after that. He took off because he knew that the response to it, as when it was published in the paper on October 7, it was not going to sit well. So I believe he wrote his letter. And I'm telling you, I think he had a much better argument with the newspaper editor. But the newspaper editor is always going to get the last word on you. And these photographs are some that James took. And I just want to put that there. Of his... the resting place of his mortal remains. And I went there with Paul and James, Michael, David, Flipper. And it was a very emotional experience to me to come from the other side of the globe and finally kneel at the closest I would ever be to this individual. His mortal remains in the ground was a very emotional experience for me. And it was sort of a form of closure. I'm flying home on Friday morning. And I think Thursday I'm going to make one more pilgrimage to this grave to pay my last respects. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I know I've kept you too long, but can I just relate one more story? It is in Cannibals and Convicts when the Vagabond is embedded with the French forces in New Caledonia. They were on a march. And at the end of the day, they'd reached a complex or the ruins of a compound of some sort. The whites went inside the compound. Embedded with them, the French, was another Kanak, you say? Not Kanak, but Kanak? Oh, sure. All right. Another allied group with them, helping the French go after the ones that they were after. They stayed outside. After everybody got settled, the vagabond, in his natural and curious vagabond nature, goes outside the compound to see what the natives or the Kanak were doing. They were led by a fellow named Nando. He was their chief, their war chief. He found that they built a great big fire, and they were dancing around the fire for whatever reason. And then after a while, they look and see that our guy is standing there. and they beckon him to come dance. Come dance. And he said, oh, no, I can't dance. He said, oh, please, yes, yes, you must come dance. He said, Australian war chiefs do not dance. But they wouldn't have any of it. And suddenly, James said, he found himself seized in the contagion of the moment, denuded of clothing, dancing wildly around the fire, gesticulating. I'm picturing like Kevin Costner in Dances with Wolves when he's going around the fire. Picture that, that type of scene. And when he finished, all the natives swarmed him. And they patted him. And they congratulated him. And Nando, the chief, gave him a black-tipped white cock feather as a gesture of their acceptance of him, which he wore in his cap. Ladies and gentlemen, from the Commonwealth of Virginia, the mother of presidents, the Old Dominion, home to the Southern Confederate capital, I accept you, your great land, your great city, your great people, this literary giant of yours. And my pledge to you is to continue the fight on the other side of the globe to learn more about James, on my end in particular. And I just want to thank you all for being here tonight, for the hospitality that you've shown me here in your wonderful city. I haven't had a problem. All I have to do is ask somebody if I needed any help for anything. And I just thank you all. Thank you so much.